know, I just love the little fucker.
That's an introduction.
Well, I tell you that, you know, when you said you love me, I asked Harriet a couple years ago. There was a whole bunch of girls around her at a where Mike died that night. I said, Harriet, will you marry me and come and live in the back seat of my car? And we'll cruise the world. And she says, you're going to have to improve your offer. But I love you too, Osprey. Anyway, Jesse, thank you for being my friend, and Joe for help. Joe helped me with a little telephone work on the way down, and God, I'm just, you know, I don't take notes. I don't put stuff down, and I should. It just starts kind of coming out, and sometimes it'll go out on a limb here, and then go out on another limb, and then it'll take me 5 minutes to get back to the stub where it met the tree, and so nothing has changed over the years. But I wanna really thank you two. When I say guys, I mean gals, you know, and for getting this thing going and re-vegetating or. You know, and I hope it can get going too. You know, I think we need a lot of the old culture to be brought forward in continuity, and this is the kind of thing that helps do that. So my name is John O'Hare, and I've recovered from that seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body. I don't say that out of bragging. I say that because I realized that that had happened to me after 3 or 4 years of coming to a lot of meetings. And I sobered up at Fremont Hall in October of 76. And I had been in and out for 5, 6 years before that, back and forth. As Jesse and I were talking on the way down, I was mentioning, you know, I kind of like to know, you know, the where people, their childhood a little bit, you know, to find out kind of what personalities they were when they were little kids. And because when you're little kids, what shows is straight DNA. Hey, Phil, I'm sorry. Oh, I'm just going to, yeah. Trish, are you Marie's daughter?
I am.
Huh?
Yes.
Oh, God, you know, I just reckon, you know, when you were up here, and Marie was Marie, I tell you, was just a, she was a dandy down at Fremont. She taught me a lot by her straight force. Anyway, I'm sorry I didn't recognize you before that. Let's see, how much time have I got?
You got plenty, go ahead. 3 minutes.
So, anyway, well, my little deal is, no, not that deal, no. My little story is that I had a Swedish mom and a little Irish dad about my size, and they got together one time when it was a full moon and the birds were chirping, and that was the start of it. And then, interestingly enough, I didn't find this out until after she'd passed away, but I wasn't supposed to be here because my mom got a deal where they had to take her lung out, and she was in the hospital, weighed under 100 pounds when I was born. And my sister told me this about 10 years ago, and I didn't, all the time, my mom never talked about that deal. But the doctors back then told her that it was going to cost her life because she was under 100 pounds if she continued with the with this deal. And she went against the doctor's orders, and she went ahead, and it happened. And the funny thing happened that she got well. She started gaining weight after the delivery. And then sometimes we've talked in humor that maybe she wishes it had gone the other way, because I was kind of a headache for a lot of them. But anyway, so one of the first things that I remember that has kind of shown a DNA in me, and that goes back to what those first 100 people talked about, is that selfishness is the root of my problem. And now, I didn't believe that when I was drinking, or I didn't believe that in the first year or so of my sobriety. As we had a, you know, nice house and nice car, all that. How could, that's not selfish. But my mind was full of alcohol. It was full of poison. It had been full of poison for a long time. One of the One of the things that I remember in 1941 in the spring, when the berries started ripening, there wasn't people around to pick berries. So the housewives and everybody that was available, and there was a lot of berry fields down in the Olympia Tumwater area. So the bus would pick us up. Strawberries was the first deal. And so we'd get our little carriers, you know, and mom would get the carrier, and then I was picking for her for about a day or so. But then some of the other little kids my age, we were getting in berry fights. And so that wasn't real compatible with my mom's thoughts. Now, it wasn't only fights, but one of the little kids would grab some berries, you know, and do that, and then come over and do that. So the second or third day, my mom asked the boss if she could have a carrier for me. So I got my own carrier to pick berries in. And none of the other kids had that. They all had to pick berries for their moms. So, and I'll never forget that Friday when they gave me a punch card, just like my mom. And so I had this little carrier that holds 12 boxes. And you take those in and you get full and they'd punch your card. Then you go pick some more berries. And then at the end of the day, the bus would take you back to Tumwater. And on Friday, you took that card in and you got paid. And that was a big deal to me. You know, I think there might have been $3 or $4 there that I got paid. And that I'll never forget that feeling about, and it was such a good lesson for me that I had to do the work first. I had to pick berries first, and then I get paid, instead of getting paid first, like some things in our beautiful country. Anyway, and that kind of followed me through. Now, I've been a little guy all my life. And so I had a kind of that little complex, that little inferiority, you know, and I was pretty insecure. But when I had money in my pocket, it made me feel good. And so that was the picking the berries. And we went from that to, went from strawberries to raspberries, boysenberries, youngberries, and ended up with blueberries. And that went on for a few years. And then I got a paper out when I was 8 years old. And I'll never, my mom and dad bought us 2 Schwinn bicycles. And they didn't make little kids' bicycles at that time. They were all standard size. So I had my TNT, Tacoma News Tribune paper bag on the front, and I had to have the bike go sideways and pedal under the bar. So you're going down the road with the bike doing this, and you're just, you know, and there was a lot of hills in Tumwater. So anyway, so then I started, I was trying to think. All of this comes down to is an exaggeration of selfishness. I was so intent on having money and making it feel good that I did a lot of work. And then I would get complimented sometimes. And I hope it doesn't sound like bragging, because I don't mean it to be bragging. It's just straight truth. I guess bragging is only in the eyes of not the beholder or whoever hears it. But anyway, so then I started doing a trap line with a friend of mine, and we trapped muskrats on Deschutes River and Capitol Lake. And you didn't have to be very old to do that. All you had to do is get the trap at the edge of the water and put the apple in it, and then come back the next day or 2 days and get the muskrat if they're there, and then you take them home and you skin them and defat them and spread them on, put them on a spreader inside out, and let them sit for about 2 months, and they get dried, and we sent them up to Klein Brothers, and we were getting $4 or $5 a pelt, and we had 50, had 50 deals. Anyway, the story being that it just seemed to keep going, this, you know, having to work and to make money. And then I was, when I was 14, I started setting pins in a bowling alley, and that was really good money. And all my bowling, all my pin setters were drunks, winos. And, but you set double lines, and you do that for 10 hours a day on a Sunday league, and then I would make $18-$19 a day on different days. Back then, that was in the 50s, and so it was always. And then I, when I was 16, I got a job at the Chevrolet garage in Olympia, and delivering parts. And I got out of high school at noon, so that you could work, you know. And so it was a continuous thing. And I was interested in drag racing, and that was just starting. In fact, one of the fellows that started the first meeting in AA in Olympia was a fellow named Terrell Pogue. And he quit drinking in 1947, and he and my dad were good pals. And anyway, he started building this dragster. So a lot of us kids, and his main thing was to get us off the street drinking and driving. And so he started a club called the Cogs, which is still going. And I think it's one of the oldest. And it was 1951 that he started that. And so that got my interest up in engine building and drag racing and cars. So I started buying some cars and fixing them up and racing them down at Shelton, and I'd sell them. And I'd get, so I ended up selling quite a few cars to high school, pals at Olympia High. And then when I was a senior, I met this little gal that was a beautiful little gal, and I was kind of a country boy, and she was a kind of a city gal. But she had a beautiful family that she came from, and my dad worked at the Olympia Brewery and came home. And I'm telling this because it sets up a stage for my behavior and what we didn't know at the time. So she came from a beautiful, loving couple. And you know, they went to Mass, or not Mass, but to the Baptist Church. And then so she hooks up with me, and we don't talk about our lifestyles at home. We don't talk about the fact that, well, my dad, during that depression, money and a job was a big thing, and you were kind of a wimp. This is sad to say, but at that time, a man was felt a little less of if his wife had to work, because his wife was supposed to be home doing the kids, you know, raising the kids, and the dad was working and bringing the money home. And so that was Dad's deal. He worked for the same place for 41 years. He drank every night. They didn't go into bars then, but at 6 o'clock, they would close, and the chief of police and the city superintendent and a few other guys would come up to the Chevrolet garage, and he'd go upstairs, and they'd drink till six to eight or nine, 10 o'clock at night. And that was standard deal. And I can understand how maybe after work, you know, they get together and talk about their day and get rid of their frustrations and stuff like that. So that was my idea of a family deal. And anyway, I moved up to Seattle in 1957 and started selling cars in Ballard at Nelson Chev. And Marlon and I got married, and we had a little deal that I was not a good Catholic, but I was Catholic at that time, and still kind of am, I think. And, but her dad and mom were very much opposed. They were Southern Baptists, so there was a little friction there. And so we decided to have the marriage at Marlin's house and have the Baptist minister marry us. And then when we got up here, you know, later on, we'd have the wedding blessed and do it the other side of the fence kind of a thing. So that's what happened. And I was working at that time at Nelson's, and I would get home at 9 o'clock, 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, and think nothing of it, you know, smoking cigarettes, of course, and drinking. And my wife worked next to Harriet at Seafirst Bank in Ballard. And Marlon, anyway, she remembers that because Ole Bardahl would come in to do his banking.
Yes.
And Harriet mentioned, she said, and Ole would only go to your wife. She'd only go to Marlon to make his bank deposits and stuff like that. And Harriet and I got a little fun talking out of that, laughing about that. So anyway, all this time, my whole being kind of is making money. Nothing about peripheral views on my family, spending time with my family. This isn't a bragging thing, but I made really good money. I was a member of the Chevrolet Honor Club for 2 years in a row. And when I was 24, I decided to go into business. I didn't talk to Marlon about going into business or anything like that. I'd saved up some dough, and I opened up a car lot in the U District without telling her. And I mean, it didn't make any, I'm the breadwinner, and it's that old deal. And I'm embarrassed to think back about how my thoughts were at that time, but that's the way it was. And so the work ethic was something that I feel bad about now. Again, the dark, selfish part of me kept grabbing a hold. And I didn't really become a full-blown alcoholic until a little later on. Full-blown, I don't know what that means completely. But I drank every night after work, like my dad did. But I didn't drink during the day. And I learned a trade, learned a profession. And I had a good name in my trade. So then when I went into business for myself, I worked 7 days a week for two years because we were stretched and leveraged out completely. And that's what I did. So the relationship, of course, wasn't getting any better there. And of course, the kids keep coming along, you know, and my brother accuses me. I have an older brother that we have a lot of fun with. And he accuses me of being home 4 times. And he says it with a grain of, he says it with a grain of humor. But anyway, so it turned out to be a tough relationship for my little wife. And she didn't know what to do about it. She didn't want to complain. And you know, it seems to be two types of people, whether they're he or she's. And the person will just keep sucking everything in and taking it in and taking it in and taking it in. And when they blow, they blow. And then another type will be, they'll take something in and they'll spit it right back out at you, you know. And so it doesn't have a chance to really build up and make a big explosion inside. And she was of that first type. So as a little time went by, here's the dark side. Now, all this time, the innocence on my part, I didn't know that alcohol was really poisoning my soul. I knew that when I drank alcohol and had more than 2 or 3 beers, that I could do things that I normally wouldn't do, and it didn't bother me. And I wouldn't be able to do them without drinking because of my soul. And so it kept poisoning my soul. And I envisioned this thing, this circle up here being all black and all white or something, you know, gray in the middle. And the more I would keep making those little selfish decisions that were fun or money or whatever, my soul would get a little darker until it got down to, in my estimation, when I was on Aurora, it got down to about a 5% white. You know, I mean, just a little, there was just a little teeny bit of thread in there of some sensibility, but not much. And so that took Marlin to Al-Anon. And then things started changing faster. She wasn't talking to me about my drinking anymore. When I went to treatment for the first time and knew the jail sentence, they made a deal up at Valley General that my wife would come up, and I'm not proud of this, nor am I bragging, but it's just how sick the thing got. My wife would come up from 1 to 3, and then Ellen would be there from 3 to 5 on a Sunday for visiting. And the two of them had met, and they knew each other, and they talked to each other, and they were decent with each other, as later on I found out. Everybody wanted the best for everybody. So when I got out of treatment, I was sober about 10 days and I went back to drinking again. And then I got sober for a year, in and out, but in and out of the program. So finally the whole thing evolved with Marlin giving me a choice of either becoming a father and a husband, and going to AA. She'd been going to Al-Anon for all those years, and or to move. And so at that time, here's another part of the sick brain. It was, you know, 95% dark. And I figured, man, oh man, this is a great opportunity for me. I'm not the one that's making a choice to get out. She is. And now I don't have to hear those goddamn kids, and all that stuff. I cringe when I think back about it, but how one of my kids would be pulling out an arm, you know, to show me something, and I'd shake them loose. And that's what happens when the soul starts to die. So it went back and forth like that, and then the money ran out, and so we had to sell our home in Enos, Arden.
You got 10, 15 minutes. You're good.
So I'm out here on that limb. I'm trying to get back to the tree. I don't know if I'm going to make it. When the money ran out, I was always industrious and good as a mechanic. And at that time, vinyl tops were very popular in cars in the early 70s. So I bought a compressor and a sprayer, and I went down and bought a molding bender, and then bought some vinyl tops. And I had a good name with all the dealers that I had been as a car dealer myself. And when the name is good, your name is good. And they don't care if you drink or not. If your name is good, it's good. You get the job done, kind of like the Berryfield. Get the job done, you get the job done. And they knew that now this time, at this time, I have moved to the empty used car lot in my trailer. I had a little 17-foot white trash lowliner. And so I lived in that trailer for 2 years and back and forth. And but I started this vinyl top company, and I had it figured out so that I trained the molding vendors. And so you paid $10 for the installation to the guy installing, and you paid $5 to the gal that goes out and talks to all the sales managers at the dealerships and to get cars to put them on. Now, I don't know what those gals did. I have no idea what they did to those sales managers. We started getting a lot of business. And it was good on my part. We had to get another installer. So they would bring all the chits down to the hippopotamus at 700 Aurora every Friday afternoon. And I'd add up all the chits and pan. It was all piecework, like berry picking.
Yeah.
So I didn't have to be there. They were promoting their own thing. And so that paid for child support and paid for, living expenses for me. And so 1976 October, my friend from Alaska that I hunted with, a fellow by the name of Jim Fisk, who I talked to Richard about, he had a couple crab boats and a restaurant. And he heard of my demise. Now, people were done with me at Fremont. I'd been in and out of that thing. I'd come in, and just talk my gut out for a week or 2 weeks or something like that. And then I'd be back out again. And then I'd come back in again. And I remember one guy, I remember when I was walking out the steps one time, and evidently somebody had stood up to come out and walk back with me. And I don't know who said it, but he says, "Hey, never mind, don't, just leave him alone." And that's, in my case, that's what it took. And so my friend Jim Fisk flew down, and he heard of my demise. I was 125, 30 pounds, and my mind was gone, and everything was gone mentally. And he picked me up and drug me back up to Kodiak to fatten me up, he said. So he put me upstairs in his Harvester restaurant, and he went over to the Burroughs building and got a couple of AA books and put down there for me to read. And he went around to one of the Solis and some of the different bars and said, "Under no means do you give this man, this boy, this whatever he is, this little fucker, don't give him any booze." And so anyway, about the third day up there, I'm walking the dock and I run into a couple of my old hunting friends that had a book called The Gleaner, and they had a contract with the government to go up the rivers and supply supplies to the natives up these rivers. And so, I knocked on the hole, and Stark Calvert came out and said, "John, what are you doing up here?" And I said, "Oh, I'm just up here." So they were just getting ready to take off. So I hopped on board with them, and away we went. Well, that night, Jim, Star knew Jim, and he said, "We better call Jim up and tell him that you're here, because a little guy like you and Kodiak doesn't stand much of a chance. You end up being crab bait." And so they called Jim up and told him that I was with them and I was drunk. So anyway. So Jim tried to get me back down, and we were weathered in. Wind wasn't flying anything. And on the third day, the weather broke a little bit, and the wind started flying again. So I don't know who Jim had. I still don't know who it was. But Jim died not too long after that. And anyway, but somebody picked me up at the airport and took me out to my trailer. And there, for me, came the most important 7, 8, 9 days, whatever it was in my life. Nobody was coming by to see me. Jim had called my brother up. So my brother came over and tried to get me to go to the hospital. And I told him I didn't know which way I was going out. And not to make this a real sad deal or sadistic or whatever it is, but I remember understanding my little Catholic upbringing. I remember that there was a God, a creator or something like that. I wasn't sure about all that stuff, but I was praying for permission to take myself out, because I was of no value. Everything I did was downside. I would go on these runs. When you go on a run, you don't eat, because if you eat, your run's all over. So you could go 6-7 days drinking Thunderbird and whatever, and not eating, and then your mind would go out. And then I would go out to my house, drive out there and try and put the key in the door, and it wouldn't fit. So I'd knock on the door. One of my kids would come to the door and said, "Daddy, Daddy." And I could hear Marlon in the background. "Is that you, John?" And "You don't live here any longer, John. We've been divorced for 2 years. And you have a restraining order. You know that. I won't call the cops, but you have to leave." Now, that happened more than once. And anyway, it's those kind of things that just, you know, it just, it takes a soul right out. So all those thoughts were going through my mind in that trailer, and I couldn't get permission in a way that I felt halfway comfortable. Now, I didn't know if there's a life hereafter. I still don't know for sure if there's a life hereafter. I'd like to think that there is, but I don't know for sure. And so the suicide thing has been a big element in my life, and not for a lot of years now, but then. And I don't mind talking about suicide because it happens to a lot of us in these rooms where families are gone and this is gone, and you know, and you're just tired of yourself and you just want out and all that. So I don't mind talking about it at all. In fact, I think it's healthy. If people have those thoughts once in a while to talk about them. And I couldn't get permission. And you know, when you talk about acceptance, and I had accepted my life as an alcoholic on Aurora, but I had accepted it to the point that that's where I was going to be, because I'd been sober for a year. You couldn't accuse me of contempt prior to investigation because I'd investigated not well, but you know, and the AA, I know it worked for a lot of you people, but it wasn't working for me. There was just nothing left. So I don't have enough time, I don't think, to, you know, this is important. I think I ended up in that trailer, I don't know, fifth or sixth day or so. I couldn't eat anything. And it was after my brother came over, and I didn't know which way I was going out. But I had decided to go against this, whatever it is, afterwards. And whether hallucination, a dream, I don't know what it was. But I had my .357. I've been a gun guy all my life, and I pulled the deal, and it's kind of humorous in a way when I look back at it, because about 20 seconds later or something like that, I went, "Oh, there is a life hereafter, and I'm there. I'm in that bad place. There was a life hereafter." And so I couldn't stand that. Now I'm just praying as hard as I can to get back to where I was 20 seconds ago or so, where I was at the most miserable place in my life. I was praying to get back to that point, and it didn't work. So the dark selfish again, I'm just going to get out of the pain I'm in right now. Now I'm in the first degree of where that is. So I pull the plug again. And it's worse than the one before. And now I'm praying like a son of a bitch. I'm praying like some, just to get back to the first stage of hell or whatever it is. And that has pierced my mind, along with the image of my four kids and what would happen, you know, when their dad does suicide. I would be giving them permission in my sick mind at that time, but it turned out to be, it happens, that I would be giving them permission. If they ever have a tough time in life and they lose this or lose that or do bad things or whatever, well, you know what? My dad took himself out. And that would be enough permission possibly for one of them to do that. So those two things picked my little fanny up. And a day or so later, I got my Datsun pickup and got back down to Fremont Hall. And that's that was the start of where things are right now. So many things have happened. All these different cycles of the contempt prior to investigation. When I was 3 or 4 years sober, and this gets back to my recovery, when I was 3 or 4 years sober, a lot of things were happening that were just kind of, they're little teeny things, but they were happening. And when I would talk about that stuff, guys like Stan or Boxcar, they'd say, "Well, that's the process of recovering." And there were some guys down there that concentrated more on being recovered than they did still being an alcoholic. And I don't get into that part of it at all. But it gave me permission when I read the book about those first 100 people and the fact that they had recovered from that seemingly hopeless condition to mind and body. And about that same time, I forget what it was that I'd done, but it wasn't any big deal. And Bill, he didn't talk a whole lot. But after this one Saturday meeting, I was talking in the meeting about something I'd done the day before, and I can't even remember what it was. No big deal. But I remember saying, "Well, but I'm an alcoholic." And so Bill, he was one of those guys that would just nail you right in the gut. He didn't give a rat's ass if you were a friend or not, or if it would ruin a friendship. Here's what it is. And he said, "Well, John," he says, "how long has it been since you drank?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, 3 years, three, I don't know what it was, but, you know." He says, "Oh, you're still blaming that incident yesterday on alcohol." And he hit me in the gut right at the right time for me. Because I realized that it was a lot easier for me to blame a selfish bad choice on alcoholism and me being an alcoholic than it is to blame on me being a sober person. So from that point on, and I took a little beating out there at Fremont, you know, when you first say that your name is John O'Hare and you're sober, "Oh, what happened? You grow a new deal, you know, or you think you can drink now?" But in my case, it was more important for me to be truthful with myself and my feelings than what they thought. And I didn't give a rat's ass, really, what they thought. I mean, my self-confidence had come back because my soul had come back. So peer pressure was not an item with me any longer. And so now I get back to the book that when I settle down, this is the brutal truth for me, is my name is my name. I am sober today. I'm one drink away from becoming an alcoholic. I have to drink alcohol to act like I did on Aurora. And the basic problem is still here. So my real name is John O'Hare, self-aholic. I've recovered from alcoholism, but I still got the ingredient in me that's going to cause me to go back there. And that's my selfishness. So, Jesse, I just want to thank you guys and Joe for coming down. And, you know, when I've seen Jesse, when you see people sometimes, and if you've been there yourself, when you have been there yourself, you look in people's eyes and there's nothing there. there's just nothing there. And when I seen you that night, Jesse, I knew, hey, man, this guy's, he's ready to go, you know? And Michelle, I sure want to welcome you. And boy, I just hope you can keep coming back and hearing all these people talk about all their stories. And they vary, and they're not all the same. And so it gives us an opportunity to, it gives me an opportunity to keep collecting all this stuff as I go by. So thank you, Astrid, so much. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
To Steve. So.